in today's episode.
Like, there used to be a question of how you're going to compete with Google, right? Like, if you're going to start an app, what happens if Google creates it or Facebook creates it? Now in retail, it's always, okay, if you're going to create a brand, how are you going to stop yourself from being eaten up by Amazon? And we were kind of discussing this a few weeks ago, and I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on that, because you guys probably had to think that through as well.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It's a very relevant question. How do you compete? It's very often about differentiation again. I mean, you have to create a link with your customer in a way that's much stronger than anyone else can create that link for your product. I think it depends on who you're competing against. If you're competing against Amazon, which in our case is not the strongest vertical where we would compete, because furniture is a very different product in terms of the buying journey. So it's much more soft. You need to be it's a more inspirational journey. It takes 7 days on average, we've seen in our data.
It's like more discovery.
Exactly. We definitely are focusing on the customer experience and specializing in that, so we can be number one there.
This is Bill Alzaidi, and you're listening to Creator Lab, where I'm learning from the greatest entrepreneurs and change makers of our time. We go beyond the surface to find the nuance in what it takes to turn your ideas into action. In a world of black and white headlines, we're looking for the magic in the gray. We're building an open and respectful community of doers who want to take action by creating. Whether that's a mission to help millions of people through a nonprofit, building a company worth billions of dollars, or changing the world through your art, we are all creators. Now let's get into the show. This episode is sponsored by Squarefoot, where growing companies find their place. They're a new kind of commercial real estate company that understands the needs of growing companies better than anyone else. They've helped over 1,000 growing companies find the right space for their needs without the hassle, uncertainty, and the time suck normally required. They combine technology that minimizes the stressful parts of the search with brokers who are market experts to help you at every step along the way. Visit squarefoot.com/creatorlab to start your search today. Hassan, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
Give you the proper handshake, the brother handshake. So, man, look, we're here in Mexico City right now. People listening, they can't see. You might hear a little bit of the loud, vibrant noise of Mexico City behind us. And for those of you on the email list, you already know that I've been traveling for the last few months, working abroad, and now I'm in Mexico City. So one of my really good friends, Hassan Yassin, we've known each other for 10 years, has been one of the guys behind a brand called Gaia. And we're going to go into the full story and what that is in a minute. But yeah, tell me about you, man. Tell the audience like what you are doing out here, man.
Okay, so I'm Hassan, you know me, Lebanese, Dutch, Lebanese parents. Yeah, I mean, I came to Mexico 5 years ago to found the Gaia brand. The story goes, the way I came here is something quite a serendipitous journey, I would say. Yeah. Kind of moving from Netherlands, where I was born and grew up, through a few countries where I did some internships in Europe, some exchanges, and then working in Ireland, and then moving to Brazil, and then coming here to Mexico.
That's a long journey, man.
Yeah.
So for the people listening that don't know me or Hassan personally, we met 10 years ago in Dublin. So we started actually around this month, 10 years ago. So kind of a crazy full circle. Yeah. That's it, anniversary, man. So yeah, man, I kind of want to learn all about that journey today. But, you know, what is Gaia in the first place? Like, you know, what kind of scale have you guys got to, just for the audience who don't know?
Sure. So, I mean, Gaia is a home and living brand. It's a brand that focuses on furniture and home decor. We started 5 years ago as an e-commerce. We started online, and then we started adding physical stores, small stores inside the city where you can kind of get to know the brand, but you can also take products with you, take home products. Mm-hmm. And today we have 17 stores. We have 350 employees. Counting, yeah, 5.5 years into it, and now, kind of like within 5 years, we, you know, typical startup, you know, growth was a very big factor, and gaining market share, and now we're at this point where the next 5 years we're gonna really, you know, consolidate and make sure we can be one of these like long-lasting love brand that people really, really like feel, you know, close to, especially the target that we have, which is the millennial audience.
Yeah. And so for people that aren't from Mexico, I was at dinner a few nights ago here and I mentioned Gaia and everyone was like, oh, Gaia, I bought this sofa from here. I bought this table from here. Like it's an amazing brand you guys have built. It's really beautiful. Like the stores look amazing. The experience online is amazing. How would you compare it to say like an American audience? Like I know it's hard to compare apples to apples, but is there like a few brands that you'd say were in that tier, you know, like there's like an IKEA and then there's like a very, very high end designer boutique with like one owner or something like that. Yeah. Like how would you compare yourself to those?
Yeah. I mean, it's very hard to compare to a brand in the United States. I would say in Europe, there are more similar brands kind of with the business model and the positioning they have in the market. Yeah. I would say kind of for the US audience, I would say it's a mix between kind of like in between IKEA and West Elm, maybe a bit closer to West Elm in terms of brand, and maybe a bit closer to IKEA in terms of price positioning. And then kind of like a layer on top, which is kind of really our flavor, is that customer experience. So, you know, just the vertical integration we did, like we have our own trucks, we have our own stores, we don't franchise them, our own website, of course, and our own customer service. So we have all the data, we have everything about your order, and we can give you the best experience possible. We bring the furniture up to your home, and people love that, especially here in Mexico. There's a lot of service culture, a lot of orientation, like much less do-it-yourself, like we grew up in Europe.
Yeah.
So here they love that, and that's been a good thing to differentiate ourselves as well.
And your role specifically, because there's three co-founders, right? Could you explain what your role is?
Sure. So, I mean, I started off as a CMO, co-founder and CMO, and then evolved into CRO, a chief revenue officer. And I think it's kind of just like an evolution of CMO. It's basically the same thing because a CMO nowadays is responsible for the growth, for the revenue many times, especially if you don't have a growth officer. So now I'm really in charge of especially the main channels. So marketing, brand team, go-to-market strategy, just basically making sure that we have awareness and that also the digital product side. So making sure we convert. So basically that whole funnel pre-purchase is what I'm responsible for.
Yeah. And because I remember just even talking to you over the years, like I've been really impressed, you know, we're like really good friends. Like we've hung out together, we've gone out together, we have lots of funny stories together. But like sometimes you have those friends, that you have those stories with and you work together, but you're one of the few people, and I haven't really said this to you in this way, that like over the last few years, I've been so impressed, just like talking to you about business, to be honest. I mean, we talk about all sorts of stuff, mainly Arsenal, but also just life stuff, which we'll get into today as well. But just, it's been really cool to see you evolve and see how you think about marketing specifically. And there's some things we're going to go into today about how you think about brand, the customer journey, and growth, sustainable growth, that has really impressed me because I meet quite a lot of people doing this and through my work. And I feel like you've got a really good balance between using data where it's needed, but then also going with your gut and saying, okay, we're not going to get the 100% picture here. We're not going to get all the ones and zeros, but this is the right decision to make. So we'll try to unpack some of that today. All right, man. So Mexico City, we're here right now on the video. You can kind of see some of it. So tell me about like, what's your impression of Mexico, man? Because you've been here five, six years now. Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible place. What has your experience been like here?
Mexico is booming. I mean, Mexico is growing, even though the economy in the last few months decelerated. But in general, the region, LATAM, it's a country that's got so many opportunities. The word is opportunity, especially compared to where I grew up in the Netherlands, where it's more of a consolidated market. There's more competition. Here you come with a strong idea, strong team, good funding. You can really make an impact in your vertical. So from the business side, it's just a place where it's really just ready to explode kind of, right? It's been like that for a while. I think it's becoming more and more consolidated now, especially when we came here 5 years ago. We were really like one of the few with a startup with proper funding and we're able to kind of like the proper disrupt really made sense here. It was really happening. And life-wise, it's as a foreigner coming here, it's a place where people, I mean, really receive you well. There's something about Mexicans that they're very open to foreigners. So So when you're here, especially in a place where we are, we're now in Condesa, which is a neighborhood inside Mexico City. It's a very friendly place to walk around. The weather's amazing.
Super
the
safe.
Food is incredible. It's safe. So people receive you very well. So that helps a lot if you come here on a journey for business, which is what we did.
But let's go back a little bit, man, because I think we talked about Google, how we met each other 10 years ago. But let's go a little bit further even before that. So what were you like as a kid? Because I didn't know you then. So like, I'm just thinking of you as a Lebanese. Your parents were immigrants from Lebanon, or were they born in Netherlands?
No, immigrants from Lebanon.
From Lebanon.
From
but you were
Civil
born
War.
In Netherlands, right? Yeah. What part of Holland were you in, and what was that like?
Yeah, so I was born in The Hague. My parents came 2 years before that, before I was born, from the Civil War in Lebanon. They left. My dad was working at the Lebanese embassy in The Hague, in the Netherlands. And then...
Was he like a diplomat or something?
I mean, he was in the diplomatic atmosphere, but that was just 3 or 4 years. And then he went on to build his own business. So definitely entrepreneurial. And then I went to international school. So I was growing up Lebanese at home. Speaking Lebanese, Lebanese food, Lebanese culture, Lebanese warmth from the mother, the father. And then, you know, speaking Dutch, being around Dutch people in the street, around the city in events, but also at school, it was in English and it was an international environment. Many, many ambassadors, children and all that. So it was a very interesting, like trilingual, but like multicultural upbringing. But then I think a key moment was we moved to Lebanon when I was 12 and 13 for 2 years. My parents wanted to move us back to be close to our family. But then there was a war broke out. But while I was in Lebanon, I was at this other school, international school as well. And I was a nerd there. I mean, I was a geek, like going after grades.
Yeah.
And there was like this system where it was competitive. So you could see kind of who was, you could see all the scores of all the kids. Yeah. It was like distributed every week. All the grades were like read out, the top three people. And I loved that. Like that got my competitive side, you know? So I was like, you know what? I'm here. I'm going to focus on this. So I the first year I came second place out of, it was I think like 200 students, like 4 or 5 classes.
Did it kill you?
It killed me to be second. Like it was, I remember it was a girl from Sri Lanka who was always first. And then the next year I was like, I'm going first. And then I got into all these extra classes and all that stuff. I got first place. And first place gives you 50% off tuition of the next year. So I felt really proud of that.
That's amazing.
With my parents.
Wow.
But then exactly when I got my grades, the same week, my parents decided, let's move back to the Netherlands because of the war. So when I moved back to the Netherlands, I was like, oh man, I did all this work. I this was my focus. And then I had to start all over again, kind of, you know, building reputation, building that momentum.
Kind of like when you left the country and moved to Brazil or moved to
like
Mexico.
Kind of like that. But then when I got to the Netherlands, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to like take a chill now. So I felt like my purpose there was like, I focused on a purpose, which was great. And then I went back to the Netherlands and I was like, you know what? That really didn't matter. So I was kind of like looking for a new purpose. And I focused a lot on social and getting to know people.
What age is this, by the way?
It's like 13, 14.
Okay. Yeah. The reason, and people who listen to this know, I normally ask about childhood a little bit. We don't have to speak the whole time about it. But the reason is the more I've learned about myself and people I meet, it's just that those formative years are so important. And it's so funny to see, like, when you said being number one, like, I only know you really socially. Like, we haven't really ever worked together, like, in the same team. But I can completely see, like that coming through in what you're like now. Do you think you're still like that now? Or have you, like, chilled out a bit?
I'm still pretty intense in that sense. I'm still competitive, like, pretty competitive. Especially when I have a game in mind, like, when I have found my game. But kind of like when I found my game in Lebanon and then I kind of like I was taken out of the game, I felt like, okay, I got to find a new game now. And, you know, and so back in the Netherlands, like I got a lot of that like love and confidence from at home. Yeah. Right. And a lot of multicultural vibe from the school. So that's kind of like pushed me to go outwards and leave the Netherlands later, I think. That was an important point.
And then you just basically left from college, was it? After college?
University, did an exchange in Italy, met some friends that we know in common and then... And then went to did an internship in Germany and then went to move to Ireland.
I'm just curious because there's some students who listen to this and they're trying to figure out like, or someone who's listening, who's got a kid, who's going to go for this at some point, or we might do as well. Like what pushed you to do those international things at that early age? I know you had traveled and kind of lived in different places, but were your family like pushing you to do that, or you saw other older cousins or friends do that?
No, I think it was a combination of kind of like that confidence that that your mom gave me all the time as a first child. You're great. Keep it up. Keep going. You know, the validation of that, of what I had at school in Lebanon with the grades that I could, if I put myself, my mind to something, I could do it. And just the whole international environment and my international school. It was kind of like I felt comfortable with new cultures. I think that made me go out and leave the country.
That's cool. All right. So then let's fast forward a little bit. So you then let's get to Google Dublin, because that's where we met. I'm going to tell a quick, funny little story, because I was thinking when I was preparing for this, I was thinking about what do I remember from them 10 years ago? And there's two main things. One is watching Arsenal. We both support Arsenal football team. And we would watch that at your apartment on Barrow Street, which I eventually lived on Barrow Street in New York. So it was this big thing, and playing FIFA. But then beyond that was this one time where I heard from, you know, that office is it was an amazing office with so many amazing people that have gone all over the world now. But I remember hearing, because there was this referral bonus, right? If you refer a friend to get a job or someone you know to get a job, you get, I think it was like 3,000 euros or something like that. It was a lot of money back then, especially given our salaries. And I just remember hearing through the grapevine that Hassan, this guy in the Dutch team, he's got like 8 referrals or 10 referrals or whatever the number was. And I was like, what? It was only like a couple of years or something that you did this. But tell, if you're all right with sharing it, like what happened? Because it wasn't a normal situation.
Yeah, well, now I've got to share it, right?
Yeah.
I think it was like 8 referrals, but basically the referral bonus, it was a pretty big bonus in monetary numbers. And I was part of this, I did my master's in this program called SEMS. And that program has also a database where there's, you know, all the students in that program, which are people who have to go through like a pretty selective process. You need to interview for it. You need to have particular grades. So it's a pretty nice list of students. And they're all looking to kind of join the top companies in the world. So when I found out about the referral program, I'm coming from this network. They're on this database, on this website. I thought maybe I can match the two, because Google, it's a win-win for everyone. Google wants to have talent. These guys in the alumni program want to have access to the best companies. Google at that time was the best place to work. I think it still is up there. And I thought I could make a nice extra bonus there. So I was living with this friend in common, Jan, a Czech friend, and he's a PhD in computer science. Add all these people who are alumni from this program, which are in the thousands. How could I refer them all? Especially because they've already been selected.
And you also didn't have the email addresses, right?
No, so I don't have the email addresses, but they're on the site. But you have to click like 5 or 6 times to get every email one by one. So it's a very
you're not going to do that manually.
Process. Yeah. Talking to my roommate back then, Jan, we decided that he would build a program. He would scrape the website and then put it into a Word file, and then that just copy pasted into emails, kind of like batched emails. And then he would get like 15% of the commission of the referral bonus. And we ended up getting, I think, like 6 or 7 from that initiative, and then another 2 from friends that I knew that I referred in the normal route. Doing that, I got mixed responses from people.
Well, what do you mean? Like, did you get in trouble?
No, I didn't get in trouble because I was doing, I mean, I was I mean, doing something that helped company. Everybody, right? Because they would also kind of get past, they had to pass the filters from Google. But some people who were part of the SEMS program already at Google, they were like, you know, you're abusing the database. I just thought it was an opportunity for
yeah,
all.
Yeah, no, win, I love win, it win, so win. Much. It's amazing. Yeah. So the reason I bring that up is one, because I only found out about this part very recently. Like you told me in the car like last weekend. But I just find that like what you're doing now and the things you've done since, there's so many times where you're trying to find new ways of doing stuff, right? And if whether that's moving to a new country and hacking how you learn Spanish quickly, or if you're, which you turned up here not really knowing Spanish.
No,
right? So now you lead a team with 350 people speaking in Spanish, and that's incredible, only 5 years. So just, you know, people listening to this, I think a lot of people listening to this are of a similar mindset. It's not about cheating. It's never about that. But how can we do things more effectively? How can we think of ways to do things quicker? And especially when you can use technology, you can make something a lot more effective. So that was really funny, man. That's pretty cool that you did that. And actually, I just want to add, in comparison to our salaries at that time, that was a significant amount of money. You know, that was like maybe your salary for the year or something like that.
Yeah, I think I doubled my year salary in that 1 year where I did that program.
So look, I don't want to turn this into a this is your life moment, but that's really interesting background. I do want to jump to you moving from Google, because this is something that everyone who's listening, who's entrepreneurial, who has a job at one point needs to make the jump. I did it this year and it was really nerve-wracking and I'm still like, what's going on? But just there's a lot of things mentally that go into that. So tell me about, like, there was a big move from Dublin to Brazil, first of all, right? Like, what went through your mind at that point and why did you do that?
Yeah, because at Google, there's this program, used to be, I'm not sure they still have it, but where after 1 year, you can kind of focus on your own project, like 20% of your time or 15% of your time. And I focused with some other guys on the Dutch team I was on building this internal tool on how to like sell branding.
Yeah, I remember being platform. In a meeting with you on yeah. that. Yeah, yeah.
And so that program had some success and I was able to apply for a rotation program within Google to go to, you know, for 3 months to another office. But you always had to have a good reason. You had to add value to that office. And then what I was able to do with that program that I was part of, that it was called Go/Branding. It was a branding solution. I was able to convince the Sao Paulo team in Brazil to take me on and teach them on that program. And I had been to Brazil 9 months before that, and I was just impressed by the culture, by the people. It was a cultural shock.
Yeah. First time you've been there, right?
First time I was in Latin America. It was incredible. And so I said, I want to be around that. I want to see what it's like there. And so taking initiative with that program and then taking initiative to apply for the rotation, I was able to move to Sao Paulo, Google sponsoring it and getting to know this entire new culture. It was amazing.
But then you got there and you decided you were going to have to do your own stuff. So like, or you wanted to leave Google, right?
I always wanted to do my own thing. And that was kind of driven by a lot of things, especially my dad. I mean, I was working with him a lot during my university years in his own business. And I saw what was possible, but also reading a lot about it. And always at Google, I think you and I also, and our friend group, we always talked about what was happening kind of like on a strategic level with the companies. Like, how was Google competing with other companies? How was Facebook doing? You know, we were always talking on a high level and that was always exciting.
We never talked about Facebook.
We watched the movie.
I was talking about this recently that's one thing I think a lot of people, there's lots of pros and cons of being in a big company. At the time, it was less big. It was 18,000 people. It's now 120,000 or something like that. But to me, the most stuff that I learned was going to TGIF, which was every week. There's like the founders, they've stopped it recently, but they would share something every week about the state of the company. Anyone could submit questions and upvote them and then they would have to answer. And then there would be internal reports about Android, I remember. Like at the time we joined, it was 4% market share. It went to 80% market share. And I would read that all the time. And I just felt, to be honest, like my manager at the time who, God bless her, but like she just was like, why are you reading that? What's that got to do with AdWords or what you're working on today? I was just like, I paid all this money to learn this at university. Like, I'm getting to see it in real life right now. I feel the same way about this podcast, to be honest. So it's just, that's a great point. And I think just for people listening, like especially people starting their first jobs or something like that, I found that learning way outside of your core role is how you really gain from being in those companies. Because there's a lot of terrible things about being in the big company too. Back to that. So you did the branding and then you got to Sao Paulo and you realized you wanted to stay there, right?
Yeah, I wanted to stay in Brazil, but at Google, I felt like, I mean, if let's say if I'm a painter and I'm painting on a canvas, I felt like I was just painting a little part of the canvas. I felt like I wasn't part of the entire painting. Everything we have to talk about and the whole tech business and technology was booming so much and changing the way business is done. But I felt like I was part of just some of the tools and some of the things happening. I really wanted to kind of be more of an architect, more of a painter on the full canvas. So I felt that's kind of what pushed me to move away from Google. But it was, as you said, nerve-wracking. It's very hard to leave Google. It's a place where you make friends. It's an incredible place to work in many ways. So it has to be a very strong force to push you away. And for me, it came from there. It came from like wanting to kind of be a bit more part of the decisions that are made in a business that's built maybe from scratch. Yeah. So I decided to leave Google then and I didn't have any place prepared. I didn't have a second kind of like a plan B. So I just kind of left looking. My objective was to find a venture where I could be part of it from the beginning.
Like a startup or something.
Yeah,
like
startup.
And just going more specific into that, because you talked about this being like, oh, okay, I'm going to leave, right? But like everyone at that moment has a thought of like, how am I going to pay my bills? Oh, do I have a visa? Like, do you remember, like, were those things relevant for you? Or did you save up enough? Or what was the situation?
No, I didn't save up enough. Really? Know, I was traveling all the time. You know, the moments we could travel when we had vacations at Google, I would travel. I would live close to the office. You know, for quality of life was always kind of something I focused on. But when I left, I just felt such a confidence about, you know, having Google on my CV. It was it still is a very strong company. And especially, and then I think the main factor is being in Brazil, being from, you know, an ex-Googler, being in Brazil, someone with a master's in business, foreigner, which is something very accepted. I just felt very confident. I wasn't afraid at all to kind of let it go and stay at my friend's couch, who was a Googler at that time as well, and look for a next step. But when I left Google, I realized I'm still missing a lot of tools on how to actually build a business from scratch. So instead of directly going to founding, I went to go work at another startup to be close to a founder and see how that goes and let that be my school as well.
What, you had quite a lot of self-awareness to know that. Like, what were some of the things that you felt you didn't have at the time? Because you can never have 100%, right? Like, and it's always a question of when do I leave to, because at some point you need to just learn on the job or as an entrepreneur to be like, okay, now I need to work out payroll. I need to work out how to fire someone, like all those things.
Yeah.
So do you remember some of those things?
I wanted to kind of like speed up my experience in terms of managing people. I wanted to speed up hiring. I wanted to speed up strategy. And that's something actually that I really enjoyed. I still enjoy a lot, like kind of designing the strategy business, which I felt at Google, I was kind of more of on the execution side. So those are the things I wanted to be, especially joining as an employee, kind of number 6, I think. I joined at the company where I went, and I left after 2 years as employee, like 150. So I got a lot of exposure to what really drove the growth.
In 2 years, it grew that much.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And it was called OPA.
OPA, yeah.
OPPA.
Yeah.
And that's an equivalent, it's a similar business, right, to what you've now started.
It's similar, like core, yeah. It's furniture. Online, and then they added showrooms and focused a lot on kind of proprietary design of furniture.
Yeah. And just one other thing, I want to go into this again. I know this sounds like very like mental and going into the mental side, but again, I think that's one of the hardest parts of, you know, you can learn from other people how to do stuff. You can teach yourself to code, learn digital marketing, all of those skills. What is consistent from the people I've met is like the mental side and the stuff they've done to actually get them in a position to feel okay. Sometimes it's natural because your mom gave you the confidence and you had a good childhood, hopefully. But sometimes it's the opposite. People had a terrible childhood and they managed to push themselves in a certain direction. One big thing I think everyone really struggles with, including employees and just in any job, is comparison. So when you're on the couch with your friend, maybe not with your friend, but in your friend's apartment and you're laying in the couch and you're thinking, I just gave up this really safe job that gave me stock and a great name that I could leverage. Like, how do you stop yourself from comparing yourself to people? Because that, to me, a lot of the time is what drives people to not take decisions they want to take. And maybe you did compare yourself, I'm not sure.
I'm sure I did compare myself to other people, but I just think it's about being so sure about your goal and then everything else gets blurred away, you know? It's like you're just so sure you don't want to be where you were that you don't think about everything else, because actually what I was comparing myself with is the people that are already where I want to be. And maybe that kind of gives you a drive to even get closer to achieve your goal.
Yeah. No, that's a great way to put it. Like a different way of, instead of comparing yourself to your friend who's earning the same money as you in the same job, it's like, no, actually these guys or girls are 10 years ahead. I want to do that.
Yeah, and I always go back to how I felt right before resigning, that I just had to do it. There was just no other way. So that kind of confirms for me the decision I've made.
Yeah. So let's really just touch on OPA. Thanks for sharing that. But OPA, so like you talked about learning by managing people, right? But by the time you left OPA, what was that stage? Where did you say actually, now is the right time? Because knowing that time is a crucial moment. And do you remember what went through your head at that time?
Yeah, I felt my learning curve was flattening out. 2 years is a lot of time at a startup, especially the way that I had gone through it, because I started as kind of head of digital marketing, which is the typical kind of move from a Google, you know, into a startup. That's where you dominate those tools. But then I started working a lot with people from the brand team. And then I started working with UX teams, building the digital product. I led the rebranding of the brand. That was a really cool project. We worked with this agency from Sweden that's super professional, and I learned a lot from them about you know, what it takes to build the pillars of a brand, the identity, not just the visuals, but what's behind it.
Is that so? Just go into that a bit more, because I think a lot of people that are like data driven, execution, entrepreneurial people, which I think both of us probably are, they sometimes will see, hear that sort of stuff. And I don't know what other word to use apart from like fluffy or you know what I'm saying? Like it's not as tangible, right? And it's a lot of like, what are our values? And I teach this course called Branding in the Digital Age. And the first time I went through the course material, I was like, I can't even say this with a straight face, because some of it sounded so ridiculous. But when I went through the exercises, I was like, oh, this is actually really important. And the best companies in the world have incredible brands. But what were those things that you really clung onto when you went through that exercise?
The value that was being created through that brand, I could see people would come in to the store, for example, at Oppa, and they would just like really, really like be excited about being there. Or we would create content that was linked to the DNA and kind of lifestyle focus. And I would see people feel kind of associated to themselves to that. I think it can be fluffy or maybe less relevant when you're focused on a marketplace, for example, where it's about network effects, where you need supply and demand. That's the game, right? And you know, or some businesses that are focused on kind of like low cost, and you want to focus on adding value and really being a player that just provides value through the product.
Yeah,
maybe brand is maybe not the biggest.
But
priority.
Even then, like I'm thinking of like Primark in Europe, right? Like Primark is all about being the cheapest, but that's their brand in a way too. It's not a great, exactly. It's not a beautiful brand that I think of, but their brand is, we're going to give you the best value.
Yeah.
And so I guess
that's
even
less
for
fluffy,
them, that's,
you know,
you're
mean?
Right.
It's
more
focused on the actual tangible product and the value you're giving to them. But then when it becomes kind of more, it becomes harder to maybe understand is when you're going more towards differentiation as a business model or a product, and you need to convince people through how you make them feel. Right. Or what part of what social signaling they get to make through being part of your brand or buying your products or services. So that's when you're starting to like really dive deep and think, okay, what's my brand archetype? What's my role as a brand? What's my purpose? How does that go into content strategy? You know, how do I push that through digital? And then those are things that are very interesting where you can separate yourself from the competition.
You mentioned the term love brand before. Could you explain what you mean by a love brand?
Love brand, I think it was, came out by Ogilvy. I think Ogilvy came up with it, I'm not sure. But it's about brands that you create this very strong bond with people because you touch upon maybe values that they have, or you are relevant in a certain way. And you kind of give them, you know, trigger them. And I think that's really important. And it's kind of going into anthropology. It's going into
psychology,
you know, and differentiating in that way.
And I think when I first heard the term love brand a few years ago, I was like, I guess everyone wants a love brand. But then when you go through examples and you see like I actually have a slide in one of the courses that I teach, and it says, like it's love brands, and it's like people have tattooed like Nike or Apple or whatever else, or Harley Davidson is a really great one.
It's a great brand.
And that's where there's like also something called like the brand arc, where you kind of go up the arc, I forgot the actual names, but
brand laddering.
Exactly. And it starts off like, oh, I know the brand. Oh, cool. Oh, now the next one is like the brand is associated with something I care about or something. And then you go all the way up right to the top where you go past defending the brand, right? If you think of like those brands that are, like polarizing, right? Or some people hate them, and then they're like, but the people that love them, they're like, oh, I'm going to defend this. And then it gets all the way to the end where people are tattooing them on their things. And I think just again, like Gaia has been an incredible example of only in 5 years. I don't know where you are along that arc, but you have differentiated yourself clearly with an incredible brand. So we're going to go into like brand in a little bit, but that was really cool just to touch on before we jump in ahead. So just to close out that last part, so you were in Oppa, you decide you're going to go to Mexico City, right? And set up this company. Take me back to that moment, because you met your co-founders at Oppa,
so
right?
So both my co-founders, one French, one Italian, they were working with me at Oppa. But when I decided my learning curve was flattening, I decided to leave. I didn't know where I was going to start, but I knew I was going to start a new venture. But I also knew I wanted to take a sabbatical and take time off, because I knew I'd read about it a lot that, you know, when you start a venture, it's just really intense and you want to just take a break. And I hadn't taken a break. Actually, when I joined Google, my first job, it was literally the day after I graduated. So I had never taken a break.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah. Wow. So I decided to take a sabbatical. It was in Latin America. And then 3 months into it, I was in Colombia and on my way to salsa class. And, and literally my Italian friend, you know, calls me on Skype. He's like, hey, you want to talk about something? I'm like, okay, let's talk. And there he mentioned to me the opportunity to start a venture with me, him, and the French friend. Yeah. And the French friend, he had already studied in Mexico before, so he knew the market a bit. And he was doing his internship at Harvard. So when he worked at Oppa, he had kind of learned about that situation, went back to Harvard, came up with a business proposal, and then thought about me and my Italian friend starting the venture in Mexico. So me and the Italian friend, we didn't even know about how Mexico was.
Yeah. Had you even visited before?
I had never been.
That's crazy.
I had never been. So when I was in Colombia, I ended up like, you know, cutting short my events and my activities there. And I ended up spending like 5 or 6 days in an internet cafe just researching about Mexico. And in the beginning, all I could read was about the drug wars and a lot of negative stuff that comes out in media always. But then looking under it, you can see it's just so much opportunity, and especially the furniture market, very fragmented. So there was a lot of opportunity.
So talk to me about that, because you, beyond the country being safe and being like a place that you want to be, you were looking at certain indicators, right? And like, if someone was going through that now and saying, I want to go to an emerging market, I want to go to Brazil, I want to go to somewhere in Asia. Like, it seems obvious, but like, what are some of those things you're looking out for? Is it internet penetration, willingness to buy online, use a credit card? What were you looking at, those sorts of things too? Or
yeah, there's a bunch of like metrics and insights you want to search for always. I mean, there's the market in general, you know. So what's the addressable market that you have? What's the supply? Kind of environment? What does it look like? You know, who is the competition? Yeah. You know, substitutes, complements, you know, the economic environment, how is it politically
stable,
economically stable? And again, like kind of the team you're in, obviously you need to make sure that you have the right team and that you can build the right product, so that you have to make sure that your value chain can be produced. So you want to look at kind of like, what's the supplier base look like? Where could we put stores? Internet penetration, I think, is key, because it would be in case, especially in our case where we use tech to drive the business model, especially through digital channel, we want to make sure that that's something that we can do.
Because when you started, it was this e-commerce though, right?
Yeah, we started as pure e-commerce.
And how long did it take to get, how many years was it until you started opening stores?
Yeah, I mean, we really believed from day one in like focus on the user, which I learned a lot at Google, but also kind of like, you know, validate from the market and get feedback and then build, kind of like iterate on that. So we had a customer service team. It was one person doing the chat and the phone calls from the first few months. But we saw like half the phone calls, half the chats were, where's your physical store? You know, people here in Mexico still wanted to touch the furniture. People everywhere still want to, you know, touch the furniture, see the quality. So there was just so much demand for this complementary channel, which was physical, that we just had to build the store. So it took us a year and a half to put our first physical store. Pretty quick, actually.
Yeah, it's really quick. And now you got 17.
Now we got 17 yeah.
And growing. Just on that, because I feel like if you went back 10 years or 20 years and you said, okay, there's this new company called Amazon, which I know in your particular case, it might not be the number one thing you're even worrying about as a brand, but just across the world, obviously Amazon is eating up retail, or has been eating up retail. And you said you fast forward 10, 20 years, and then you look at the numbers again and you say, what percentage of commerce is online? And I don't know off the top of my head, but last time I looked, it was like maximum 20% or something still, right?
And that's the US.
I think so. It used to be like 15, like, 20%.
15, 16, yeah.
50, yeah, okay. So I was probably rounding up just in case I haven't looked recently. Yeah. But right, so for that, when I started at Google working in a retail team, it was 10%. It was 10, 15 already. So a lot of people don't know that, right? Because we got so used to using Amazon Prime, getting it delivered the next day and doing all these things. What would you say to the person who thinks that physical stores aren't necessary? Because I don't think that's the case, but I'm just curious. A lot of people do think that and they don't know the facts.
I mean, in Mexico, that number is actually 4%. So it's even more relevant. But I would say even at 15, 20, 25, 30, you still have a big part of the market, which is still buying offline. Obviously, but looking further than just that metric, I think it's really about like, you know, today's consumer doesn't necessarily look at these channels as separate. It's just, how can I get to know the product? You know, and if I happen to be walking around and I see a store, or if I happen to, you know, someone wants to come with me and get to know the brand a bit better, how can you be there for them? So I think every channel has its different objectives and different value. So a physical store still does things that you can't do through the pixels of a smartphone, which a smartphone can do much better maybe than a physical store, because it saves you time, it saves you energy, it's quicker. But a physical store will allow you to engage with the customer one-to-one. It'll allow you to listen to them and offer them maybe a service or advice, especially with a product like ours where the average ticket size is $400. It's not a purchase that's impulsive. So you want to make sure people understand well what they're buying. And also, especially when it's a soft needs, like, you know, it's styles, it's moods, it's they need that kind of guidance. And you can do that in a physical store. So I think the question is more what value and what purpose will physical stores have, and how will that change towards what it is today?
And where do you think that's going?
So we're about to do something kind of in 4 months from now. We're going to launch a pretty cool iteration of our stores. I can't say much about it yet. I want to come in with a surprise.
Yeah, we'll get an update in a few months.
It's going to be incredible. But kind of rethinking the role of retail and especially focused on experiences, and focused on getting to know the brand, focused on diving deeper into what's behind the brand. And I think that's something that's a really interesting experience. And also merging it with other experiences that you already live, that you're already doing on a Saturday or on a Friday after work. How can that store still be relevant to you in that moment? Not necessarily sell.
No, I can see that just even hearing the way you talk about, like you talked many times there about focusing on user, giving them value. It's not just about sell. I think when you're doing that and you've got three people working on your team, that's a lot easier to do than when you go to 350 or 10,000 one day. And one thing I've struggled with in the past is when I manage people's or team, that to translate what you want in your head on paper and making sure all the incentives and the KPIs are aligned, especially when it comes to something like brand, right? So like a traditional marketing org would have very direct response, click, 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 sell, revenue numbers. And then you've got like the brand metrics and stuff like that. How do you think about coming up with those KPIs and making sure that everyone is speaking the same language? You know, because I remember working with a retailer in particular who said, we don't care how much we sell offline, we need to hit our number for online. So like, we're not even going to advertise the local stores, you know, because it was like a Google product listing or something for them. And that to me was like a huge flag, because if you told the CMO or the CEO that, they would fire that person, right? But how do you get around doing that as you scale and grow? Because I think you've done that pretty well. Yeah.
I think there's two things in there. The last one you mentioned, which is more like, you know, we need to grow online very fast. I think that's looking at it more from the business side, kind of like, you know, looking at your different channels. You know, there's all this hype about e-commerce, and obviously e-commerce has changed a lot. But in the end of the day, it's one of the channels. It's one of the ways to get to your customer. So if you're pushing artificially on one channel, if you're forcing the customer to use one channel, you're going to probably spend more money than you could if you're not being as efficient, probably with the way you're spending it and the way you're developing your channel. So the way I see it is, you know, let the customer choose the channel, but just make sure you're ready with the way, you know, where the customer wants to be and how they want to interact with you. And then you'll see what the numbers are. You'll see kind of as a result what your share of sales is in all the different channels, right? The other question about like, how do you align people when the company's bigger? That's a massive challenge.
That's hard, right?
Yeah, we're now 350 people. There's so much written about this, about, you know, how you go from like a family into a tribe, into a village, into a city, you know, a country, kind of like depending on how many people you are. And the dynamics change. You need to start thinking about how do you communicate things in an efficient way? How do you make sure everyone's aligned and you go into one organism? I think one thing we're focusing a lot on now is the OKRs, which we learned at Google.
Objective, key results.
Objectives and key results. So you define the objectives of the company and then the key results, which are the pillars, the main things you're going to do to reach that. And you can define that for all the teams. So everyone's kind of aligned for the same objectives in the end of the day. So that's one of the tools. But in the end of the day, it's all about tools, but it's also about leadership. You have to really show every team how they fit in to the main organism, to the main vision. Mm. So it's a lot about the why behind it, explaining why they're relevant and what they're doing. That's another big factor because, you know, 3-4 years ago, you're 100 people or even less, you're 50 people, you're all almost in one room. It's much easier to kind of like push people towards something then. But later you have to think about tools and the why behind it, I think.
We kind of talked a little bit about Amazon a second ago. And if it's okay to dig into that a little bit more, you would be counted as a D2C, direct-to-consumer brand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's obviously a very hot space right now. We've got big brands like Away and Warby Parker and these billion-dollar brands that have been created. And some people have the opinion that they're overvalued and their unit economics might not work in the long run. I don't know enough about that to make that statement. But one thing I always struggled with to figure out is if I was trying to start a retail brand or a consumer-driven brand or a D2C brand, is there's always, like, there used to be a question of how are you going to compete with Google, right? Like, if you're going to start an app, what happens if Google creates it or Facebook creates it? Now, in retail, it's always, okay, if you're going to create a brand, how are you going to stop yourself from being eaten up by Amazon? And we were kind of discussing this a few weeks ago, and I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on that, because you guys probably had to think that through as well.
Yeah. No, it's a great question. It's a very relevant question. How do you compete? It's very often about differentiation again. I mean, you have to create a link with your customer in a way that's much stronger than anyone else can create that link for your product. I think it depends on who you're competing against. If you're competing against Amazon, which in our case is not the strongest vertical where we would compete, because furniture is a very different product in terms of the buying journey. So it's much more soft. You need to be it's a more inspirational journey. It takes 7 days on average, we've seen in our data.
It's like a lot more discovery.
Exactly. Right? Since the moment of like necessity is formed, or you create the necessity through, you know, seduction, or you actually create that need, it takes 7 days on average for them to make the transaction. So that process, often it's not just about the algorithms. It's a lot, and algorithms are relevant, but it's also a lot about like kind of someone coming in and telling you, okay, this can go well with this. What's the space?
Like fashion is a similar.
Just like fashion. I think fashion is another thing where Amazon also hasn't been their strongest vertical, and I think they're trying to crack that. But I think furniture has that aspect, but it also has the delivery and operational aspect where you need to make sure you're not damaging the products when you're delivering them. You need to maybe help with installation, assembly. Yeah. It's a pretty tough business. It's a pretty tough vertical to crack, especially if you're kind of scaled like you are with Amazon. Yeah. I think in terms of Amazon, that's kind of like where we see it. We definitely are focusing on the customer experience and specializing in that so we can be number one there.
And I think you just touched on a point there, which is like logistics, right? Like you can't deliver a sofa through UPS or, you know, normal postal service. You need someone to bring it in with white glove service, especially at a certain level. I think of like really expensive stuff, like the other vertical I've looked at in the past is like diamonds. There's a reason there are people buying diamond rings online, but Amazon generally isn't selling them, right? So, and that was one. And then you kind of touched on brand as well, right? Because Amazon, of course, has an incredible brand, the most valuable company of all time, depending on what numbers you look at, I guess, or when you're looking, I mean. Like, what about that? Because, you know, let's say Amazon says, now tomorrow we're going to open up a whole new specialized division for furniture and it's going to be Mexico City because we see this huge potential. How do you still think about differentiating from someone who's so much bigger and more powerful?
I think, for example, in furniture, it's not so much about, I mean, there are iconic furniture pieces where you buy it because it's kind of, that's the name of the chair. You know, there's like, you know, Charles Eames is a typical designer who has his own furniture that's just, you know, it's recognized. But in general, you choose a brand in furniture because you believe that brand is an authority in design. And often these brands are able to create like a narrative behind the products, which push you to then buy that product specifically. Instead of it being a price game or an algorithm, it's like you fall in love with the product. Yeah. And a brand that knows how to tell that story about a product, that's a strong edge combined with what we talked about with the experience. So it's like the full journey. You inspired me, you seduced me, and you also gave me a great experience.
Yeah, you keep saying the word seduced, which I like, but what does that mean in the context of this like customer funnel? Because I haven't heard it described like that, actually.
Yeah, so seduced, I would say it's kind of more like, we use that word internally, kind of like inspire, seduce, guide, and give. It's kind of like, this is like our version of the funnel.
Of the funnel, okay.
So seduce is more like, you know, first inspire, you know, you kind of give them like tips about how they could decorate, how they could live. You show different shots of products. And then seduce is you start telling them the details of the product, what it would look like. Maybe you use AR, like augmented reality.
And they can visualize it in their own space.
Yeah, so they can show it in their own space through the camera of their phone in the app that we have. So you're kind of like already making them imagine that it's in their space. And then you empower people, or you kind of like give them, you guide them, let's say, by giving them at least all the information. For example, a sofa on the product page, you need to make sure you have a lot of data, like a lot of descriptions on it.
Like so the dimensions.
Dimensions, how it sits, is it comfortable? And for another company that's kind of a marketplace, it's often hard to kind of standardize these product pages. So you want to make sure every category has its own product page descriptions and guidance. So that's guidance. And then you give them the tools to buy, which is a physical store near you. It's an app. It's a mobile site. That's you know, you thought about the usability. So the omnichannel thing is the give part.
Yeah, yeah. Did you come up with that?
Yeah, I mean, with the team.
With the team. That's really good. I haven't heard that.
So it's adapting to your business, to your vertical, let's say.
Just one other example, if we're okay to talk about, IKEA is the big elephant in the room in furniture, right? And I was actually listening to a podcast 2 hours ago, and they talked about apparently last year 1 billion people went into an IKEA store, which is crazy, right? So from my understanding, they're not that present in Mexico, but one day they might be. How do you again kind of think about differentiating from a brand like that, which is a massive company, not Amazon though, and they are trying to meet, there's definitely a lot more overlap.
Yeah. So definitely in our case, I would talk more about IKEA than Amazon in that sense. They're coming next year, and it's one of the most incredible businesses ever built on the planet,
of course,
arguably. So in terms of the scale they've created, the value they add to their customer in terms of the products and the low cost. So we already obviously thought about this a few years ago. So we've already kind of been preparing. It's very important to prepare. Again, it's not about winning the category. I think it's delusional to think you can compete against an IKEA within 5 years. So they will obviously be market leader once they come, and it won't take them very long. But it's there's always a second player and a third player that's relevant. And you can see it in most industries. And so we want to make sure we have that very clear position. That's second place. In 3 years from now, we want to be Gaia and IKEA in Mexico, really being the go-to. And you kind of choose which one fits you. And IKEA, it's a lot about kind of one size fits all. It's a great price. But at the same time, you need to assemble it yourself. It's a process that's a bit kind of like, it takes longer. So
maybe the products,
exactly. It's products that are a bit more kind of standardized in their designs. It's a very functional product. So we've decided to kind of like position ourselves, but it's not because of IKEA. We're actually kind of going where our DNA is.
Yeah,
we're
just being authentic to ourselves.
We've been doing this. We're just kind of exaggerating it, or not exaggerating. It's we're making it clearer. So we're focusing on the design aspect, the lifestyle that we stand for, and the experience that we offer you. So with us, you buy, you fell in love with the product, but also we put it in your home for you according to how you told us you wanted it. So it's also more one-to-one. And much more designs oriented.
And you're a Mexican based company. There's the local feeling.
The local feeling is a really interesting point you touch on, because we're not here to say that we're made in Mexico, which we are, because most of our products are actually built here as well. And they're designed as well here, designed by our team. But there's a very interesting trend happening in Mexico in the last 5 to 7 years, where it's called the emerging Mexico, which we are very much part of. It's a breed of creative people and brands that are giving Mexico a new name and new vision. What I described to you before when I was researching Mexico, when you would read all that stuff about that was big there, especially with the drug war that happened in two administrations ago, that was making headlines. Now Mexico is making headlines through the chefs that are building incredible restaurants on Chef's Table on Netflix, or the directors.
Yeah, the
art or like directors.
Roma, that movie.
Yeah, Roma, the movie, or you know, all the other movies that were directed by Mexican directors, incredible creative people who are giving Mexico a different name, and actually the name that's correct. There's so much creativity here. It was just kind of like put under all
like
the other bad news.
It wasn't dormant. It was just not. People didn't know about it.
People didn't know because the other stuff was so overpowering. So now the good stuff and the creative stuff is coming out more, and we're part of that. We were born here. We're part of that flow. So that's part of our narrative as well.
So you talked a lot about growing really quickly, and that's incredible. In 5 years, you've already grown that much. But you had talked to me a few days ago when we were kind of discussing like how business is going and how life has been here. And you talked about this term, let me make sure I get it right. You said the term growth debt. And I hadn't really heard of that term before. And I think you kind of made it up on the spot.
I made it up on the spot.
Yeah, we were just talking. You're like, it's kind of like growth debt. But that sounds kind of like, well, you know, let's explain what that means. So you were talking about, I guess, the growing pains of growing very quickly, if that's how I took it. And when you're growing with the objective of revenue, and growth, because you're a VC-backed company, and that generally is the case with VC-backed companies. There's sometimes growing pains or things that you don't get to focus on as much. And there's like the debt of your growth. That's how I took it. But is that how you would describe what you thought at that moment?
That's the way I would explain it. I mean, look, we're lucky to be talking about this, you know, to get to 5 years into it, have more than 2% market share of the furniture business in Mexico within 5 years, which is a huge vertical, huge industry. That's for us a big achievement. And obviously, we're backed by venture capital, which is very focused on top line and growth, which makes complete sense. And I wouldn't do it any other way, starting again. However, there is a point where you get in 4 or 5 years, you know, you're lucky enough to have made it, and you're actually growing, and you're actually, I think we're the third brand in Mexico that sold most furniture this year. So. Like a pure player. So we made a lot of progress. At the same time, you know, you're 350 people, you start to not know the names of everyone, which makes a lot of sense. Yeah. But also you kind of like, you go quicker in terms of, infrastructure, culture, you often take shortcuts, which is normal and many people understand. And obviously you always make sure you're kind of doing the minimum on these things to kind of keep going. And obviously some points you get like red flags, and there's always kind of different areas to focus on. But once you reach this point where we're in, we need to really like sit down and think, okay, how do we keep growing at a great pace? But at the same time, how do we kind of create a different part of the roadmap, which is focused on this debt that you're talking about, this cleanup of the infrastructure, maybe spend more time with people, maybe go on more lunches with the employees, and discuss what's happening on a day-to-day basis.
Really design the culture what it should be consistently. Yeah. Like that's something that is really important as well.
After a while, it's not enough to say, guys, we need to keep growing faster and faster. It's not enough as a why, you know, and you need to, you know, really, really take the time for that. And it's actually a very laborious process. It's actually a fun process, but it takes the time and effort, and you need to put it into the strategic roadmap. That's the difference. And I think it makes it's completely normal to be in this position. And I think it's also healthy to put it on the radar and step by step in parallel to your growth efforts also add, because we have focused on one side thing a lot next to revenue, which is the experience. So we now have a net promoter score of 70, which is a lot for furniture. It's the promoter score is a scale from minus 100 to plus 100.
Yeah.
We're at 70 now, which
70, that's like really high, no?
It's very high. It's very high. So because we focus on our own trucks, the training, the experience. That's where we really don't have much debt. But I would say especially on culture, on spending time with people, I would say that's kind
and
of
you're saying
main,
even
main
infrastructure
factor.
Because that's such a, I don't want to use the word boring, but to a lot of people it's boring, right? I'll say me personally, right? If you're a creative person, you're thinking about the customer and the brand and all this exciting stuff. You forget that, oh, we're still running this part of the website or this billing system, which we need to upgrade because that 5 years ago we set it up because it made sense and now we've outgrown it, right? And I'm just making that up on the spot. But even just from my own experience in my last role at Charity Water, there was a whole year where the whole product team, half of what they were focused on was just infrastructure. And it was the same stuff. They had built something 10 years ago and it was still working, but like not working optimally. But when you go to the investor equivalent or the donors, say, hey, we're working on upgrading our product system. Like, they're like, what are you talking about? Yeah. You know? And, but I do love that because I think we're actually hitting an inflection point, right? We're in 2020, pretty much now in the new decade. We've had 10 years of, you know, where if you go back 10 years ago, tech was exciting and fun and disruptive and seen in a positive light. And now we've come full circle where Mark Zuckerberg is in Congress and Google's being sued and being fined, and rightly so in some cases and maybe not in others. And we've kind of come to this full circle where this mindset of, what did Mark Zuckerberg say?
Like growth, move fast and break things.
And break things, yeah. Right? And Reid Hoffman has blitz scaling, right? So those are the sorts of mindsets that have got those companies to these incredible stages, and they've generated more value and wealth than most things in the past. But we're also seeing the negative impact of that. And we're starting to say, okay, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And that comes from the leaders doing that, but it also comes from consumers. It comes from Wall Street or investment markets saying, actually, we need responsible growth. We need sustainable growth. Comes from the government too, of course. So I really love that you brought that point up, because I think we're at that stage now where I think even if you're VC backed and even if you want to make all the money in the world, which is I'm not against doing that, there still needs to be a point where you say, actually, we need to make sure everyone feels valued at work, even if it's something to do with that. And maybe that takes away 2% of our margin or whatever it ends up being. But that's more important because we value that as part of our organization. So what are some of those things that you're focused on now that you guys are prioritizing it?
Yeah, as I mentioned, really, really nice explanation, because like it's a lot about the people, as I said, the culture, but also processes, as you said. And it's the stuff that doesn't make it into the maybe the board slide, or it does, but it's not the most fun to talk about. But it's about how do you create better workflows between teams, you know, especially an omni-channel business like ours. It's just so many moving parts. Like, and right now we're working on we're upgrading our ERP. Enterprise resource planning system.
Yeah, what does that mean for people that don't know? Is it like supplier stuff?
Yeah, it connects also to our suppliers, but it's basically like a backbone system that allows us to better plan, better understand how much we're using of our different resources in different areas. It's very important for the finance team. It connects to our inventory management system. So it's a very important part of that, let's say, platform that we need to create, but also kind of hiring more people that are project managers, for example, more people who organize workflows and organize projects. That's the kind of stuff that you have to stop, and not just people who design strategies and launch new products, yeah, but also people who kind of like put people working together in a more efficient way. Or, for example, you know, we started doing this thing called Inceptions this year.
Yeah, what's that?
They're meetings where we put together, like, let's say we're launching gift cards, which we launched in December, for just before Christmas. You know, what does the Gaia gift card look like, and what's the scope for that project? So we put in together someone from an IT team, someone from the marketing team, someone from the UX team, someone from retail. And then what we do in there, it's like, I think it's called the Inception methodology. That's what we call it at Gaia. It's like a 4-hour meeting, but you describe really well, like, everyone's idea on what should be done. And then you end up coming on a consensus of what's the final product going to look like. Not just the product, but the go-to-market, the technology behind it. So it's like a 4-hour laborious meeting.
That's very
meeting,
interesting.
But,
yeah.
But you do that, and then you come out with everyone understanding and agreeing on it. Rather than, you know, as you would do it as a startup, maybe in your first year, second year, you're kind of like on the go. You're just kind of like doing it fast, iterating, you know, stop, define it, and then launch.
Right, really be, what's the word, intentional about it.
Exactly.
I love that you said, like, the IT guy and the person customer service, because those two people both need to be involved in that discussion, and most of the time it's not. It's like someone's pet project in the marketing team or something like that. That's great, man. Thanks for sharing that. I think just as we're going to close out soon, but there are a couple of things I would love to just... We talked about branding before, but I would love to just finish off that thought, because I had some more thoughts on it. And one of them was around, when we talked about this last week, you talked about the term network brands. I've heard that term, but I haven't really thought about it as much. And I think you think so long term about what you're trying to do with Gaia. And just could you explain what that means to you? And is that something you're striving for within Gaia as well?
Yeah, so definitely thinking of like how we can keep growing and become even more relevant in the market. Network brand is a term I learned from Scott Galloway. It's a NYU professor. I was at one of his conference where he spoke
in New York,
in September, New York.
Yeah.
But kind of been thinking a lot about around that idea of a brand that dominates its brand territory, but not necessarily the market it's in, but the lifestyle it represents. So, for example, in the United States, there's Equinox, right, which is a gym. It started off as a gym, and now it's doing many more other things. It's doing some fashion. It's going, I think, even into a cafe, restaurant, even into food, I think. I'm not sure. But we see our brand as a, like the purpose of the Gaia brand is to empower you to design the life that you want. That's actually our slogan, design the life that you want. So whatever fits under that mission, not whatever, obviously it's curated and it's linked to that customer journey, we want to think of and build a brand that encompasses a large part of that territory, but not focused on just the market, but focused on that lifestyle and that mission that we push, that creative spirit that we have.
Mm-hmm. Because when you say a life, that means your home, obviously, but it means beyond that as well. It's extending beyond that, I guess.
For us, it's not just the home, because you can also be at work where you're engaged with our spaces. You can be in a co-working space. You can be even on the move. We're thinking about ways where we can be relevant, representing you in that moment, in that space. So where our expertise can add value. So there are things that are like lateral, like very relevant. I would say something similar, maybe a bit more technical, is Airbnb, that went into experiences. They went into other things. I think it's often very relevant to take. They're obviously seeing it as like a travel category, and they're going after travel. And I think it's definitely the way to look. How can you be relevant in? But the beautiful thing is they use their local flavor, which was. It was a local way to live through the homes, but it's a local way to live an experience
through
too.
Experiences.
So it's nice to see how their spirit, which is local, you always hear them talk about local, local, local. They still use that as a criteria to think, okay, what's the lateral businesses that we're going to launch?
That's a great example, because I guess when they started, it was all about feeling like a local. You go to San Francisco, like we're right now recording in my Airbnb, right? So it's I get to stay in someone's house who lives there most of the time, and now I'm here for a few weeks, and I get to walk downstairs and go to a local coffee shop, and it's a completely different experience to a hotel. And but I think before Airbnb started, you wouldn't have even thought of that wasn't really a way of traveling. You know, maybe if you stayed in, you could, in some countries you can stay in people's homes, but the closest you got was like a hostel, but that's just like backpacking traveling style. That's really interesting. So for you guys, have you thought about other categories that you could potentially go into one day? Like based on what you are?
Of course. I can't say much about we're going to launch some really interesting stuff in the next few months. But basically, like if you would look at Airbnb and their local nature, for us, it's like that wow effect we create through, that we've been always doing since we were born here, which is, it's so easy to scroll through the design that we offer. It's unique designs. We deliver it to you with no friction. That wow effect, how can we bring it to more spaces, but also through more categories and parts of that customer journey? And so we have the DNA for it. We really believe it. And we can offer it and capture a bigger part of that customer journey.
Yeah. So just to close out the branding part, because I think one thing you mentioned earlier was about omni-channel and having stores and that experience. People want to touch the table and really feel it. When I came to your office a few days ago and you said to me, oh, have you been into the store yet? And I said, no, I haven't actually been inside, but I've seen it several times. And you're like, yeah, what's this? And you open up your computer and you open Google Trends. And I love this more than anything, that you open Google Trends and you typed in Gaia, I think, and you basically saw the uplift when you opened that store, right? And what I loved about that was because as we look at retail evolving, we're now seeing a lot of people saying, we don't even need to make money from the stores, which I think hopefully they can, but they are such amazing branding vehicles or experiential vehicles that they're kind of needed for that purpose. So could you kind of talk about that example and how you've seen that across the board for the company?
I mean, that store you're talking about, it really was like there's a before and after putting that store in terms of those Google Trends, people searching for Gaia, especially in Mexico City. It's in a very central place.
Where is it for people that are familiar
with? It's in Roma.
Okay.
Close to Condesa, where we are now. But basically, you can see it as a experiential billboard that sells. And if you look at it that way, it's actually extremely profitable in that sense. I mean, basically, the rent is I think, 2% or 1.5% of the revenue that it makes.
So
it's
really?
A very, very good spot. Wow. Obviously, you gotta be like, there's, you know, quick to get these spots. It's they're not everywhere to get a place like that in terms of the location. It's on a corner. It's sticking out.
Yeah, you see it as you walk.
You see
past.
It as you
it's
walk.
Near a main road.
Yeah, yeah. We did an activation with a Mexican emerging artist where it's graffiti and it's a lot of color, so you even see it even more. And that store is incredible. And we're gonna do much more work on that store to make it even more relevant. So, yeah, it's. I mean, we almost forget the value of awareness that these stores create, as
Completely.
You say.
If you don't mind me digging into that number, you met 1.5%. Is that quite that's abnormally low? Or
that's a pretty good number in retail. Yeah. I would say it's even closer to 1%.
Is there a range in retail? You don't have to say your business in particular, but like that you guys see. Like, is it like 10%, 20%? Is there to compare it to?
Sure, to be honest.
Okay.
But I would say maybe it's around 5 to 10%.
Okay,
could
so
be
it's just
in many,
doing very well for that. That's amazing. And just, I mentioned Google Trends, and your background was in digital marketing, right? So you're a technical digital marketer. And what I love about when we speak about marketing, you've got all the brand stuff down, man. Like, you really get it better than most people I speak to. At the same time, you haven't lost sight of the data-driven approach and the kind of technical side of marketing. And can you talk to me about like how you see the CMO role or the executive role anyway evolving, and how that kind of, you know, we were talking about this idea of different worlds coming together, and your world before, you didn't know anything about furniture, right? Like you had to learn it. So could talk to me a bit about that, because I think anyone listening to this who's interested in something can apply the same approach to their own work.
100%. I think, you know, especially like 10 years ago, 7 years ago, that CMO role, marketing teams, there was so much hype about digital marketing because, and it makes sense. These new tools were coming out, adding a lot of value through metrics, you know, attribution modeling, measuring everything, you know, and I think there was value in it and there still is value in that. But I think it went overboard. I think we started hyping up these channels, even though they add a lot of value still today, we started hyping up the visibility that these metrics give. Just because we have numbers doesn't mean that we're measuring the right thing. Often, especially in an omni-channel model where people, you know, let's say today, you know, around 40% of people go from online to offline in our journey. Right. So today, half of our sales are online, still with 17 stores.
Half.
It's a pretty big. Yeah, pretty big.
That's really big. Yeah.
Big number. But still, from that 50% that we sell in these 17 stores, 80% of them, so 40% of total sales of Gaia, are online to offline. So people actually research something about us online. It can be the site. It can be our Instagram page. It can be our Pinterest. Actually, on Pinterest, we have the same amount of views that we have on our site.
That's crazy.
Every month.
Yeah.
It's a very relevant tool before in the customer journey. And they go to the physical store, and often they're not logged in. That cookie is not tracked into the store in the browser. So often you're not understanding how many people actually you're moving. How do I give you that number, that 80% of the regional store? Is because we actually have a survey in the store. Every time we do a sale, we ask, where did you know about us? And that's an old school way of doing it.
I remember you mentioning this to me, and I was like, oh, is that easy? And you're like, yeah, because you can't get 100% of the data anyway, even if you're using the... No, it doesn't mean you shouldn't try to use those other tools. I think there's benefit. But that gives you the directional number that tells you, okay, this is working.
Yeah, and more directional. Sometimes you have to also understand the limitations. And often, I think what you mentioned before about like how some brands wanted to push their online sales artificially. Yeah. You know, you got to be realistic about where are the limits of the technology. Especially when you're on, you know, omnichannel. Look, if you're an eBay... Right, or if you're Amazon, I would really, really double down on that stuff, on the technology, on metrics. I mean, it's the recommendation engine, especially because they've actually cracked attribution, because when you go into their Amazon Go stores, you got to go in with your app. So they actually, that's actually for me the real solution for attribution. And they can actually use metrics to have that full visibility.
Because it's first party data, it's their own data.
It's their own data, but you actually need, when you enter, I think when you enter the store, you need to like check in with your app.
Yeah,
I haven't been into one of those stores, but that's, and you actually like check out as well. So you know exactly what they bought in the store. So it's an amazing way.
You know where
they
walked around as well, which is kind of
crazy. Yeah, you know
where
you walked. Yeah. So, I mean, that's, okay, that is a solution. Not everyone is able to do that. So until you're there, you need to make sure you focus on things that give you insights that are kind of at least directional, as you say, or pulses. So maybe it can be a survey after every purchase. It can be focus groups. I mean, talk to your customers about how they perceive your brand. Like seven people on a table will give you so much insights about how people are receiving your communications, what are new trends that you should be taking into consideration in your tribe. We call our customer our tribe. You know, what are they concerned about today, you know? And you get those things when you're close to them. So, and it sounds old school to do a focus group. Not everything is through, you know, Messenger and or getting through surveys, and you can launch those as well through email and all that stuff, but there are other ways to get stuff.
But even just because you use the word focus group, which is a more of a formal way of getting people around the table, but like for a small business owner who might be listening to this, like you, or even yourself, like going into a store and talking to people is
that
a focus group, you know?
We just did that. Sorry,
oh, really?
Okay. We just did that. Yeah. We had someone from the UX team, user experience team, was also focused on insights. He just spent 3 days last week just outside our stores, three different kind of parts of the city, different profiles of customers, maybe looking for different things. Kind of one's in a shopping mall, one's in a street. And his job was to interview, exit interviews at the stores.
People
leaving the stores, some bought, some didn't. And a set of questions, understanding why. His objective was to understand how is our value prop being received by our customer. Value prop, I mean our product and you know, our full product and pricing and experience in the store. The whole experience plus product. How is it being received? What is missing? And I mean, the value out of the report he generated was incredible. I mean, it's so much that's going to go from that report that's kind of validated into the roadmap for the coming year.
That's amazing. Because even just from my working with other brands, not to call anyone out, but just like sometimes they're the most intelligent people in the world, but you can tell they're not asking their customers or their users, like, why are you using this in the first place? You know? And I think it's different for a store because clearly it's a little bit more obvious. Okay, I'm coming to buy a piece of furniture. But if you're building software, that to me is even more so, like you need to talk to every single person, you know, as close as you can. And actually the last episode I did on here was Rahul, founder of Superhuman, the email app. If you haven't heard it, if you're listening to this, they've gone through a whole extreme way of basically surveying everyone to understand why they're using it and what they don't like about it. And in fact, they're actually getting rid of people that they don't serve them properly. They just don't want to be distracted by them. So it's different obviously for a retailer, but I think that's quite an interesting approach for software. Last thing, just to tie that all up, because we were talking a little bit about merging different skill sets and we kind of just touched on it there, but just even for yourself, and we were talking about this the other day where we've all been at transition points in our career, and you were saying you think that people should just go and learn a skill that they might be good at or they want to learn, and then go and apply that to a different field. Could you just kind of elaborate on that thought a little bit more?
I mean, I'm seeing, at least at Gaia, and I see it through many colleagues in the startup world, that people who come into these companies, especially in the smaller companies where it's very fast moving. I mean, people who are succeeding, it's not so much about people who have the background skills that are necessary for that role. For example, someone in the marketing team that studied marketing. Often it's someone who maybe comes in from a different angle. It's someone who's proactive, someone who's maybe even eager to learn about marketing, but maybe apply their skills that they've maybe done through computer science. For example, the guy I just mentioned who did the studies and the exit interviews, he's in the UX team. So he's more of like a product designer. So he's designing different features on the site and omni-channel features, but he actually is a developer. So the last 5 years he's been in development, but he's super eager about UX, usability, research. So now he's the head researcher, let's say, in that team. But whenever he's kind of doing that research side, which he has a lot of passion for, and he brings down the insights and then he starts thinking about solutions and how to design the product, he knows what's possible because he understands the coding side of it as well. So it's so efficient, that process, because it kind of brings together his passion with the tools that he already has
and the skills
to building the
and he's
feature.
Got a fresh perspective on it too, right? Because he can see under the hood. Okay, cool. Yeah, that's someone's asking for this feature, but how would that actually work in reality? That's a great point. And we were talking about there was a book you mentioned.
Andy Grove,
who became the CEO of Intel, I think.
Exactly.
And what was that like? Because I haven't read the book, but you said it was an incredible book.
I mean, that book, if I would advise one book on management, it's his book. It's called High Output Management. Yeah. Andy Grove, ex-CEO of Intel. I mean, I remember his background is in engineering. So what he did is he applied a lot of, let's say ways, like perspectives of engineering, output, efficiency on the production line, all that, into management. So how can you be efficient when you are managing, one person, a one-to-one, or if you're managing a group of people, or if you're in a meeting with a group of people, or if you're doing an all hands, how do you talk to them? How do you... what do you say in those moments? How do you maximize your leverage? That's how he looks at it as it.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting.
Very engineering way of looking at it.
Very engineering way. It's like efficiency. And it's. I don't think it's the whole, obviously you need to kind of add more factors to management, but that's a very, very refreshing way, as you said, refreshing way to look at management and be effective, especially as the company grows. I mean, Intel at that time also was growing a lot. And so how do you keep being relevant in different stages of a business and in different moments of the company?
Yeah. And I think the two examples we just mentioned were two people that were technical that have now expanded into something else, which is definitely a big trend. I think those skills are always going to be needed. At the same time, there are people, if you're listening to this and you're not a programmer, you're not a computer scientist, I think it applies as much to you as anyone else too, because what I think working with engineers, traditionally speaking, and this is generalizing, is they wouldn't have necessarily had the experience of talking to customers or knowing like the use cases. And so someone like a guy that we both know, one of my really good friends called Pete, he still works at Google. He went from being the number one sales guy, on the phone sales, like cold calling sales, to now is basically on a product management track. And he's taught himself UX and user experience because that was his passion. But he understands the consumer from the sales side to a certain extent because he was having conversation with them every day. So I just think that is an interesting way of like seeing your career, especially in an age where people aren't staying in careers for 30 years in the same company anymore, or they don't want to stay in the same role for more than several years. And I think you can take your experience and put it into a new industry or a new role, and that just extends your how excited you are about your job or your business, if that's the case. Thanks for sharing that, man. I mean, I know it's getting late here. We need to go eat some tacos or something soon. We haven't had dinner. But listen, Matt, we talked about so much stuff. Thanks a lot for sharing everything. Was there anything else that we didn't get to talk about that you wanted to kind of share before we kind of wrap up?
No, I mean, I think it's, I would say just like you're here now in Mexico, I mean, come and see it for yourself. I sound like the tourist board, but it's an incredible place. People receive you so well and there's a lot going on. I would also say like, if there's people who are, doubting, making a move towards what they really feel like is kind of their calling or what they really need to be doing, I mean, really go for it, because like you what's the worst that can happen, really? The worst that can happen is you go back into what you, somewhere else where you were doing what you were doing. And maybe do it a bit more, if you're not sure about it, maybe do it a bit more thought through, maybe save a bit more money, or maybe start as a side project and then kind of see how that goes and then make the leap. But definitely do it. I mean, there's so many opportunities, especially when you kind of like take your skill set or your passion and you go into something different, something new. I think there's a lot of opportunity there. So definitely go for it.
Yeah. So 10-year plan, we're both going to Arsenal. We talked about this.
Yeah, we talked about that. I mean, Arsenal. I mean, we wouldn't talk about Arsenal. It's another hour and a half.
That's true. We got
podcast, another, maybe even 5 hours. But
yeah.
But we'll leave that to AFTV, another channel.
Yeah, exactly.
But there we're talking about, these directors. I think there's a movie on that, like 10 years ago. Moneyball.
Moneyball,
exactly.
Great,
where someone comes in with like analytical skills and changes the game and becomes successful. I think even in football, which is a big passion of ours, the same club. club as well in London. But, you know, how can you take in these analytical skills, leadership and management skills, vision, and maybe that can be a big value for a massive brand like a football club. People, that's a love brand, actually.
It's 100%. Yeah. It's more than a love brand. Yeah,
it's incredible.
I talked about tattoos and the bar that I watched the Arsenal game in the East Village in Manhattan, where I used to live. What do live? The guy has a cannon tattooed on his neck, man, which is an Arsenal cannon. He's a real gunner. Yeah. He's from Brooklyn. You know, he'd never been. He hadn't been to London before.
So maybe you can balance that love brand with someone who comes actually with the numbers or looks at things in a more
different
analytical
way. Or progressive way, I mean, just talking about football as an industry, really quickly, because just looking at how broken some things are, it just feels like there's lots of potential for innovation and change, you know, and that's the longer term plan, you know.
Let's see
That's it. Well, listen, brother, I really appreciate it, man. This has been great.
Thanks for inviting me.
It's really great to see what you built here and meet your employees and see all the great you're doing here. And you know, people listening to this know how much I'm passionate about, you know, you can actually make a change. It doesn't always mean you're saving the world, but you are adding value to customers' lives, to you're paying people salaries, you're making things better in a way, and you're changing things for good. And I think that is a great thing in today's world where everything is so polarizing and we're going around in circles on the political circuit. So congratulations on that, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens from here, man.
Thanks, man.
Appreciate it, brother. Thanks, man. Cheers, man. I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please share this with your friends. I'll be bringing you some incredible guests over the coming weeks. You can subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, or any podcast app you're using. You can also subscribe to the email list on the website. Just go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. You'll be able to get every single episode, free giveaways, and exclusive content straight to your inbox. You can also listen to all the episodes on creatorlab.fm with all the show notes, books, links, any resources that were mentioned in the conversations. And please say hello. You can send me an email directly. That is hello@creatorlab.fm, or just find me on any social network. The username is creatorlabfm. I look forward to hearing from you. Enjoy.